everyone. Welcome to the very eerie, extremely wicked, and quite spooky podcast hosted by Raven and Ree.
I'm Raven.
And I'm Ree. And we just want to welcome you to our pilot episode for this podcast. We are so excited.
Everything for this podcast came up pretty quickly.
Yes.
It was just something that we were on like the phone on FaceTime with one of our group chats, and I think we had started talking about like Nickelodeon and all the Nickelodeon conspiracy theories, and I was like, oh my gosh, like we should start a crime podcast or, you know, a mystery podcast. And then it just all kind of came to fruition, you know. For those of you that don't know, Ree and I have another podcast called The Bite Podcast with Raven and Ree, and we are mainly talk about Twilight, but kind of dive into like the world of fantasy. And so we had already been working together from that. We had both decided that we're going to start writing a book together. And then now we're starting another podcast together. So
another one.
Yeah. We love true crime, mystery, conspiracy theories.
Yes. It's going to be a whirlwind. We're going to do this podcast structure different compared to our other one, where in our other podcast, we mainly just talk, we come up with topics, and we bring them to the table. This, we're going to do seasons, and we're going to have each season have a specific theme about either true crime, conspiracy theory, and then we'll have each episode pertaining to a case that is on that. So for this pilot season, season one, we're going to be diving into the perplexing world of cults, which I think if you're any true crime junkie, then you know of cults.
And I think a reason I had said in the trailer that it would be so ironic for us to do cults is because we are in a cult, the Twilight, called the Twilight fandom. And so that's so I was like, why not start off with cults, you know?
Yes.
Because I mean, hey, some of these cults are start off as like little, you know, fandoms in a way, you know?
They do. And they come together with a common theme, and then before you know it, it can go one of two ways. There are some cults who are very peaceful, but there are other ones that turn more malevolent, whatever the word is, and it just and especially the one that we're going to be talking about in today's episode, which we've been hinting at on our Instagram, and I know a couple of people have commented how excited they are for this, because this is a case that if you know of cults, then you know of this case. So we're going to dive into the tragic, the very terrifying and tragic cult, The People's Temple, from Jim Jones. And how we're going to do this with this podcast is Raven and I did some research. We're going to do some research. We're going to talk about the case. And then at the end, we're going to just give our thoughts, talk about, like, do we think this could have been prevented? Do we think about, like, just our opinions and how we see the sides?
So. Yeah. And we do have a very long podcast title, but it's not for no reason. It's because at the end of the second part where we give our opinions, we'll be determining whether we think the case or whatever story we're talking about for the podcast is either very eerie, extremely wicked, or quite spooky. And we'll be kind of diving into that and giving our opinions in the second part. So this first part is all about the facts, what we know, and, you know, nothing that's, you know, our own opinion. We just want to lay it out there.
Yeah, so we have some, we've both been watching some videos, some documentaries. I have a few things here from, like, Britannica, the History Channel, and a couple articles, and it was from a student journal about it. So we're going to just dive into the details first.
Yes. So we know that things kind of started taking off for Jim Jones and his church in like 1954, but I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about Jim Jones and his like childhood life a little bit. Because from all the documentaries that I've watched and all the videos I've watched, it didn't sound like he came from a very loving family. His mother was the breadwinner, so she had to kind of like work all the time, and she wasn't very like motherly. And his dad had PTSD, alcoholic problems, because he went to war. I believe he was in World War One. And I think his father even had, there was like a gas attack or something, and something happened where he got, his lungs were scarred. So his father was very ill for the most of the time and didn't work. So I think that through this, not really having a very like loving home environment is what led him to getting into the church, because his mother was actually reports from what I was watching is that she was kind of outspoken and kind of said that she did not believe in a higher being or anything like that. So he didn't come from a religious family and he just got into it.
I have this right here from Britannica talking about how when he was young he became a regular churchgoer, and then it was after he went to college that he entered the ministry with like no pressure, because usually people who enter it, they come from a very, very religious background. So the fact that his parents weren't really like that, it's one of those rare cases, especially back then, where someone who wasn't really like an avid church girl just went themselves.
Yeah, and then some childhood friends and family members of him had said that when he was younger, that he every day to school he would wear a button-up shirt and slacks, kind of like church like outfits. He would always carry a Bible with him, and that he would, even when he was younger, he would go and kind of preach to like animals or anyone who would like listen. And then there is also, I think it's a cousin of him, if I'm not mistaken, had said that that's when he would start seeing kind of like his diabolical side, to where, you know, he, if you were there watching his like preaching when he was a kid, he did not want you to leave. And so I think he had like locked up his cousin or neighbor and like did not let them leave. Little things here and there that kind of showed that he wasn't like, I guess, sane or, you know, that.
There were signs.
Yeah, there were signs. And what interested me a lot about him, and I think we'll find a common theme when we talk about all of our other cults, is that people said that he was a great leader, you know, and that's a common theme within all cults, is that the leader is, has everyone always talks like everyone loved them, you know?
They have like very charismatic personalities, and it draws you in, and that's why, like, because I've always, when I've gotten into true crime and when I learned about cults, which I found very fascinating, I always had this like mindset, like, how could these people like get like how could people worship these people and all that? But it's like you said, they're very outspoken and great leaders that drew them in.
Yeah, and so then I think he met his he I, when he was 17, I think he graduated a little early, and he started working at a hospital, and that's where he met his wife. And apparently, after he was working in the hospital, he wanted to go into the medical field. That he thought going into the medical field was his thing. That he would love to help people. And then him and his wife got married, and she was her and her family were very, very Christian. And there were reports to say that Jim Jones wasn't necessarily Christian, and he was that he was kind of agnostic in a way, but and so that they would get into a lot of arguments because, you know, she was very Christian and he wasn't that Christian, even though he was an avid churchgoer.
Yeah, he was kind of starting to move into creating like his own like, is it called denomination? I think diminution. It's like a part. Yeah, it's kind of like, because I know in the LDS church they have like several, kind of like how like we have Protestant and Baptist. It's still kind of in within Christianity, but it's a different, separate kind of one.
Yeah, I think it is domination, right?
denomination. It starts with a D.
Yeah. Words. What are vocabulary words? So then, another thing that I found really shocking about him was that he was a social justice warrior.
He really was outspoken. It says right here that he gained the reputation as a charismatic churchman and was a vocal prominent of racial integration and position that ran afoul in some church elders. Because it was during a time where we were in the civil rights movement was taking place.
Yeah. And he got his start in Black or African American churches. And he just really loved the spirituality and the environment. And whenever he started preaching, he catered to minorities. Yeah. And he spoke of, you know, equality. And that was really shocking for people at the time. Because for a straight white man to preacher to come out and say, you know, everyone should be equal no matter what, was very, not for the times.
Yeah, and he also had adopted several children. Because I remember watching a documentary of his African-American son that he adopted who had survived this. And that's what a lot of people, also what drew him in was he had adopted several children from different ethnic backgrounds.
Yeah, and I think him and his wife only had one biological child. And I think he had 4 kids total. One of them was biological and the other 3 were adopted.
Yeah.
And so that was really strange for people because, you know, that was not something that people would do at the time. Another thing, I mean, even though considering towards the end or the later parts of the church, I mean, his church did do some pretty, you know, great things, I would say. You know, they opened shops where people would go and donate stuff, clothes, toys, etc., kind of like a Goodwill. And then he would go to different stores or restaurants that were whites only, and he would ask them to open their doors to everyone. And if they would say no, him and his church members would go and protest out and kind of, you know, like drive away business. And then when they finally agreed to let everyone, like to be inclusive, he would have this pamphlet of lists and lists of stores that were that allowed everyone. And these businesses would get ton of business from his church members. So, I mean, those were some more progressive things that his church did do. And in 1954, he opened a church in Indianapolis, and that's where he preached about racial equality. So, I mean, he was really big in doing that.
Yeah. That's, I think, what really drew a lot of people. And when we get to the end, unfortunately, it's that group was the main people that had what happened. And it just, it breaks my heart because it's all like, these people came to Jim Jones to be equal and to have these freedoms and praise love. And then you get to the end of what happened and it just...
So about 10 years after he opened the church in Indianapolis is when he kind of started trying to start his own denomination. He claimed that the Bible was false and that he is God's true prophet. And this is where we kind of get into his little scamming things, because I do know that they would do healings. Right?
Yeah.
And he started off, he said that, I remember seeing something where it said that he needed to gain their trust, so he would do little things like cure a headache, cure a cough, and then once he got their trust, he would move on to bigger things. But then, because I guess word was getting around about this preacher who could heal people, and he would go traveling to other churches And he would plant some people from his church who were in on this little secret, and they would go sit in the audience, and he would pick them out and heal their headache or heal something, and they would just scam these people at these other churches. I know that he would have a nurse, male or female, go around to the person who had who he thought had cancer that they didn't know about yet, and go with a swab in their mouth, but somehow they would get a piece of chicken liver and put it in their mouth. And obviously, if you have something in your mouth that you did not have there, you're gonna like gag or something. So they would start like gagging, and then he would be, he would do his preacher stuff and, I rebuke you, spit it out or whatever. And then they would throw up this piece of meat, and they would be like, oh, like you're cured now. And they would think that it was true that they had cancer and that he cured them. And that's how they got a lot of their money, by these like scam healing stuff that they did. Which is
Is
sad, but I it's just opinions till later, but
yeah.
he did do some pretty shady stuff. Like when he that I think that's when I when he realized that I think he could control people like that, gain their trust, get money, that's when I think things progressed.
Yeah, that's when it started becoming more diabolical and cult-like,
And
because they were just in too deep.
yeah, exactly. And I know that he also started doing drugs, heavy
Oh,
drugs.
yeah.
And
Yeah, he
that's why
did.
anytime he's depicted, he has, or seen pictures, he has glasses on. And or sunglasses, right?
Yeah.
And there was even a comment on one of the documentaries, like, never trust someone who wears who wears
Glasses
sunglasses
indoors.
indoors or whatever.
Yeah, my dad would tell me that all the time. Like, never trust someone. And I'm like, why? And he's like, because that means that they're on something.
Yeah, and so he didn't want his church members knowing, because his eyes were bloodshot red because of all the drugs he was doing.
Yeah.
And he didn't want them to know, so he would wear sunglasses, but he would tell them that it was because that since he was God's prophet, that the light of Jesus Christ was like shining from his eyes, and if they saw it directly, that they would burn. It would burn them. So that's why they passed it off. They're like, okay, cool. Like, I don't want to get burned.
He was very good at manipulating his members. Oh my gosh.
Extremely. And I want to talk about something, and I think this was before they ended up moving to Jonestown. But his wife was bedridden because she had the back issues. And so she would stay home, take care of the kids, but she was sick and could not really move. Like, it was a serious thing. So she wasn't able to please him sexually. And he had an affair with one of his church members who was like 19, 18, something like that. And he didn't want his church members to find out about this. So he came clean to his wife, told his wife, but he spinned it in a way to tell her, like, since you, like, I still want to be married to you, blah, 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 but since you cannot please me sexually, I have to go do this. And she said, okay. So then he's, had affair, and then he told his church about it, and they were like, I agree, yes. They were like, yes, you should do that. And he, like, imagine just being in church, like, and you're the girl that he had an affair with, and he just airs it out to everyone.
I would be mortified.
Mortified, right?
Mortified.
And that wasn't his last. He ended up having lots of mistresses.
He did. He went
He
around.
did go around. He
Let
does a
me
couple of movements, right? Like, they move from, I think they ended up moving to like LA or San Francisco.
Yeah, it says here that for like as you said, first they started in Indianapolis, and then it was in 65 that there was fear of a nuclear war happened, or he fe I don't know if it was like there was, I can't remember if there was a fear of a nuclear war happening. I think it was, because this was 65. This was after, 2 years after Kennedy died.
Yeah.
And I know during Kennedy's time was the Cuban Missile Crisis. So I'm not sure if this, if it was also happening during 65, I'd have to check, but it was this because of fearing a nuclear war. He moved to San Francisco, and that's when he had adopted the name The Prophet and became obsessed with power.
Yes, and his church wasn't first called the People's Temple. It was called something else.
It was called Wings of Deliverance.
Yes,
and, in 55.
And it changed. This is what I saw, and if it's not correct, but the documentary I was watching is that they had bought a building for their church, and it used to be a Jewish temple. So it
a
had,
synagogue?
Yeah, and on the outside it had the word temple, like, carved into, like, a sign, and so he kind of, like, changed it to the People's Temple.
Yeah.
He was like, I don't want to do any extra work, like, make the new sign, let me just, the People's Temple.
And when he was
in San Francisco is when he gained a lot of power, I think, because
what happened was his church in Indianapolis was still like going. He had just like I think by then he said that, because I saw a video where he had about over 1,000, close to 2,000 people, like, members of this church.
Yeah.
But he kept part of them, I think, in Indianapolis and had someone there running it there. And then he moved the majority to San Francisco. And this is where allegations started happening about abuse and that he was taking the money and using it for other things. And then that is why that's what kind of progressed him to move to Guyana. Mm-hmm. Was he knew that he could not get there was something going on that he knew that if he was in Guyana, the U.S. government couldn't do. I think it had to do something with taxes and money.
Probably, yeah. Well, so, yeah, because I know that churches have certain rules about their taxes, so he was probably breaking some laws, and he was probably going to go to jail.
And I think this is when his paranoia also very started, because that a lot of the articles I have noted that during the last couple months in Jonestown, he became increasingly paranoid.
Yeah, and I mean, also, like, he's taking tons of drugs.
He's abusing his members. Because I think what happened was Jonestown was a agricultural commune, and he promised this kind of socialist type where they give him everything and he's gonna promise to give everything back.
Mm-hmm.
But then he never did. They gave him everything and he didn't do anything back.
Yeah, he had purchased this land, and it was mainly jungle.
It was, like, 2 miles from the nearest freshwater lake.
Yeah, and so they built cabins for church members. He had a very nice cabin, though, with a generator and fans and a refrigerator. And his before they moved, he was already starting to, like, hint to his church members, like, something's going to happen. We're going to have to move. Something's going to happen. Kind of getting them hyped up about, like, oh my gosh, we're going to go. We're going to be free and spirited and whatever, right?
Yeah.
So I think when they ended up going, I think they originally left, like, almost 700 people went. But then towards the end, they ended up getting tons of more people. And I think it ended up with, like, closer to 1,000, like, 900 something.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and they have small cabins for these people. So the living conditions were terrible.
Terrible. He would not give them food if they didn't do what he said. Like, he starved them. He threatened them with blackmail and beatings. And he had like an entourage of armed men around him at all times.
Yes.
Who would commit his, like, beatings for him.
Yeah, and if someone, the craziest thing, if two people from there wanted to be in a relationship, they had to apply to be in a relationship. And if they wanted to
Yes.
separate, they would have to get approved to separate. And the guys, I like the craziest thing to me is that it's not just adults that are here, there are children that are living there with their parents.
I think it says 276 children. So close to 300 children were here, and it just the those conditions are not suitable for children at all.
No, at all.
They barely had fresh water. I mean, their clothes would probably be soiled because they didn't have good water to shower all the time,
And
and it
actually, they
wasn't
were told
promised.
when they would shower to close their eyes because the water was so polluted. So they didn't want the water getting to their eyes, but they were bathing with it. They're mainly for like beverages. They would drink water or they would drink Kool-Aid, because it was cheap and it was easy to mix into the water and get taste of something. They lived off of peanut butter jelly sandwiches, which as a kid, I mean, if I were a kid, like I'd probably want peanut butter jelly sandwiches every day. But as a growing child or grow like an adult, that is not enough to sustain a meal.
It's nowhere near, there's no nutrients, like you're not getting the daily calorie intake you're supposed to. These people became malnourished very quickly.
If someone broke the rules that he had set in place, he would make them run everywhere. And like no one was allowed to look at them, no one was allowed to talk to them. And if you did, you got in trouble. So I can see there being moments where these people are happy and thriving, but then I can also see moments where they're just like, what did I get myself into? You know?
He wouldn't let these people go, like, contact their family back in the US, because not everybody who was there, like, their whole entire, because a lot, because there was a couple people. I remember I was watching Investigation Discovery. They had a whole, like, 2-hour documentary on this with some survivors and people who, lived to tell what happened, including his adopted son who survived. And a lot of these people completely just packed up their entire family, like generations of family came. But then you had other families who thought that their family members were crazy and like, what are you doing? Like, this is not gonna end well. And so the ones who were back in America had no contact with the ones who were in Guyana, and that's when allegations and people writing to Congress happened.
Yes, and this is where he kind of, this I think, I mean, he's always paranoid, but this is, I mean, paranoia at its highest. So what he had did one day is he said, emergency meeting, everyone, we need to have an emergency Congress like meeting, right? They go to the church and they're there, and he tells them, like, they're coming after us, we all need to drink this Kool-Aid, you're gonna die. Like, line up and get in line, and like we need to do this because if not, like they're gonna come kill us. But like if we're already dead, they can't do that. And he was able to see who was gonna go do it willingly, who was gonna be the problem, and they did. And then after everyone drank it, he tells them, okay, that was like it was like a joke, that was just a test. Like you're not gonna die.
I would be so terrified. It just,
At that point, I would have wanted to die. Like,
yeah, like Jesus. And that's definitely where, like, the paranoia, and I think that's, and he wouldn't let these people leave. We take that into note. He would not let these people leave. They wanted to go. He always kind of would say, oh, yes. If you want to go home, if you want to go back to America, then I will allow it. But then when they go to ask him, he said no. He was holding them there against their
they
will.
would so he would anyone who was there and they would get a social security check, he would keep all the money. So and in order for them to leave, they had to pay to leave, but these people had were making no money. Some of them were able to pay to leave and then they did, But they would be like forced or signed a contract to say that they could not say anything about what went on there. All the mail was regulated. Anything that came in was opened and checked before it was given. Anything that went out was proofread before getting read out. And if there was a note that said something like, oh, like, all we had today was peanut butter jelly sandwiches, they would, you know, make them go back and say, like, oh, like, I love eating, like, we just eat peanut butter jelly sandwiches. It's so much fun, you know, like, change it to look make in favor of the church. And that is after the relatives started going and voicing their concern, the people who were still in the U.S., is when a congressman had went to go visit.
Yeah, Representative Leo Ryan from California. Yeah. He brought a whole team. He brought members of his like delegation, like his secretaries and his law clerks, and then relatives and an NBC crew who were doing a feature, which this, when we get into it, either our opinions or when we talk about it, there's going to be a thing that happened with one of these NBC people that I think is what caused everything to happen.
Yeah, so basically, he goes to you know, kind of check things out, like put maybe the family members at ease. And then they go and kind of everyone's on their best behavior, smiling, whatever, putting on a facade. But I think this kind of set them off is when some people had came up to him and told him, like, can we please leave with you? And he said, sure, let's go.
They were also giving him notes that had details of what was happening. And, I mean, it says that if you see the feature, they still have the feature of what took place, and Ryan is talking about how, like, you guys all look like happy people, and they're all clapping, and I think one of his law clerks that survived, who is now a congresswoman, she said how it was just a very odd feeling how these people were clapping a little too loudly. Like, some of them were a little too overjoyed.
Too happy and it, kind of thing.
Too happy that, and she it's, had it's the kind feeling. Of
like, this is maybe like a terrible analogy, but when there's like a household with abuse in it and you go over and it's just like putting on a show kind of, you know, and you can tell, but there's always something off. Like, there's something off. So I get that. That's the analogy that comes to mind. So when they're trying to leave, they leave with 16 people.
Yes. But
when they were fleeing, they were being shot at. Nothing happens when they're being shot at. But then they get to the airstrip, and the security guards of these people got there and killed the Representative Leo. Three of the reporters and one of the people who tried escaping, and they wounded a lot of other people.
And those who were, because they were still shooting at them, like, the entire time, they did not want any survivors. So these people had to flee into the jungle of these harsh conditions. Some of them bleeding out, had been shot multiple times, and not knowing if they're after them. And then you've got, at the same time this is going on, you've got Jones delivering his final sermon. But the thing is that one thing I forgot to point out was there was actually another camp called Georgetown, not too far from Jonestown, and that's where Jones had his several of his like people. Like, there were some of his sons, and I know the one son that was in the documentary I mentioned earlier, he was there, and he heard the radio going off, and there was a phrase that he knew indicated mass suicide was taking place. And his wife was there. So he tried, it was very sad because he knew what was about to happen, and he couldn't do anything. Like, the people wouldn't let him leave to go like stop it, because he couldn't. So I guess now we can come to the conclusion of what took place at Jonestown.
Oh, wait, and hold on. Because after, because this thing, he told them that they all had to commit revolutionary suicide. It was the term. And, yes. So they forced people to drink this Kool-Aid that had cyanide in it, I think.
Yeah, it was cyanide laced. And so he first had the children go first, and the nurses and mothers took like mini syringes and like forced it down their mouths.
Yeah, and also some people had like syringe marks on their arms if they, because I guess they didn't want to drink the Kool-Aid, so they were like injected into them. And it took about 40 minutes for everyone to kind of pass away. So after all the 912 people died, he shot himself, but he wasn't the only one who was shot. One of his mistresses was also shot. So I don't know if he shot her, but I guess we don't really know that who shot her or if she shot herself. 85 people survived, but only because they were away.
Yeah. From they were either that. Yeah, they were either in Georgetown or they like and I have some theories I want to get into after when we get into our opinions.
Yeah. But yeah, so, I mean, and all these people died. And then after, I think since the representative didn't return, you know.
They sent.
The Guana, I think.
Yeah, the Guyanese officials. They had, it says Guyanese officials had arrived the next day. That's where they found it carpeted with bodies, and you see like the infamous shot of the helicopter gazing down at the main campground. And so
now we get into our opinions,
theories, comments.
When I was watching, a lot was coming to my mind. A part of me was like, did he, I mean, he was very racially, you know, wanted everyone to be racial equality, but then part of me was like, was that a facade? Like, was that true?
I completely agree. I feel like maybe it did start out, as, good, and he did want these people to be equal and all this. And I think as his obsession with power grew, it became more about just
targeted.
And he knew he could manipulate these people into coming into this church because of this act. And it's
it's like, especially in those times, I mean, obviously we weren't alive, but I could just imagine how, you know, people of color feel at this time. Because, you know, they want to be included and, you know, they've been through hardship and finally there's this white man and a church that's equal and everyone can be there and they don't have to feel like they're the others or they don't, you know?
Yeah.
And so part of me was like, part of me thinks that it was like, I think it did start off maybe as something good, but I agree with you that I think that towards the end, you know, he kind of was targeting them more.
Yeah. It's very sad. And it just made everyone vulnerable. And and part of me thinks that this could have been prevented because one thing I want to mention, and this is kind of one of my theories of why I think this could have been prevented, or it wouldn't have been as, like, on the level it was during this feature, they had the NBC reporters there. They were doing a feature on Jonestown. There was a part in the feature where they sat one-on-one with Jones, and he had his whole entourage of people, his armed men behind him. They had a one-on-one interview. You got the cameraman, the main reporter there. I think Ryan was there, or he had just moved. He was talking with some of the members. And the reporter confronted Jones with one of the notes from the people. And you just see his face kind of turn this. I can't even describe it. It just turns completely he goes from this, like, the act was falling apart, and he did not look happy. He picks it up well afterwards to kind of make it look like he's not phased, and how, oh, they can leave if they want to, but you can tell that after reading this note, he was not happy, and I think that's what set into motion for him to ambush them at the airstrip and do the mass suicide. Was he knew
that was like the first domino, kind of.
So it makes me wonder, and if this reporter hadn't confronted him with that note and instead kept it to himself and they left and was able to bring back people, do you like, could have this been prevented?
I think it could have. Do I think that maybe sometime down the line something else would have happened? Maybe.
Yeah.
But would it have been to the extent that it was then? I don't think so.
Yeah.
And I also think that, you know, because there was already investigation about him. So they went, kind of were keeping a low profile, made it all happies and smiles like he wanted. And then they left and he was like, okay, tricked them, got them. And then they went back with all these notes with these people. They would have had the CIA and FBI would have had enough to come get him.
Yeah.
And do an ambush and rescue these people.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not like he thinks he's a prophet, but he doesn't have enough prophecy to know that the CIA is about to come, you know.
Yeah.
You know, everything that he thought was speculation, except for the part when he moved to Guyana because he was under investigation for fraud. Tax fraud, probably.
Yeah. It was a domino effect. And another theory that my dad actually came up with this, because my dad's also kind of very interested in this, especially because he grew up when this happened. He was like, this happened in 78. My dad was just about to turn 20.
My dad was 4 years old.
Your dad was 4 years old. Oh my God. My dad was born in 59.
Wait, I'm trying to think, like, what is it? My mom is 70. Whoa, hold on. I was like, wait, when is my mom born? Yeah, my dad was 4. My mom was, like, born that year.
Oh, my gosh. My mom had just turned 10. My parents have a 9-year difference, but okay. They met when they were legal, I just want to say. Nobody come for my parents. They met when she was 23. And, so my dad is very interested in this stuff because he kind of witnessed it. Like he remembers seeing it on the TV, and he doesn't think that Jones committed suicide. He thinks that someone, one of his boys, like one of his entourage, shot him and escaped and is out there. And because, I mean, I think it's an interesting theory because when I heard that he had shot himself, first of all, I was like, okay, coward. You're going to make all these people drink this poison that you did, and you're not even going to go out with them. And so the fact that he shot himself makes him a coward. And then when my dad...
That would have made more sense because one of his mistresses was shot too. So what if she got, like, she was shot because of, like, you know, crossfire or something.
Yeah. And so who knows? And this person who, and if this person who did do it, like who did shoot them and escaped, he probably is still out there and is just not saying anything because he does, like, he wants to keep it to himself. He doesn't want his identity to be out there. So when my dad said this, he said, and my dad's like, the only way you can tell, you'll know, is if they found gunpowder on his fingers indicating that he did it. And I don't know, I'd have to check if there is facts, because it says, because all the reports say that it says Jim Jones, age 47, was found in a chair dead from a single bullet wound to the head, most likely self-inflicted. So even then, it kind of leads open, was, it's a, and no, this one
it
says self-inflicted.
Sounds like he was in the chair just like watching everyone die, no?
Yeah. So, like, it's very interesting. So, who knows? Maybe. I like, the more I think about this, the more I'm kind of leaning. Okay, maybe he was murdered.
I think it's possible that maybe one of the members, you know, saw that all these people were, you know, dying or, you know, passing out. And then maybe he hadn't, like, drank any yet. So, he was like, what, like, what are you doing? And he was like, no, like, if you're gonna go and kill all these people, like, you need, and maybe he had already drank the, maybe the person who shot him had already drank the Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
And was just like, well, you know, like, I'm gonna die, so.
You're gonna die too with me.
And they started off with all the kids, right?
They did.
To me, I think, I don't want to victim blame, but, you know, the adults were there, free will, they, you know, they can make their own decisions, but not really because they were being held, but they had a choice to be there, you know, they chose to go, but the kids had no...
Yeah, and a lot, and, like, these kids were a lot, like, when you're five... You're not gonna, like, you know, understand what's happening. And most of these kids probably were like, I don't want to drink it. And then they had to force it down their throat. And I just, I'm the same. And
the fact that some, I mean, I don't know, how, like, there was 912 people that died.
Yeah.
I don't know if, what is the percentage of those 912 people who were like, let's do it? And the other percentage that were like, I don't want to do it, you know?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there was the reports that some of the mothers were even, you know, helping it put the Kool-Aid down their children's mouth.
Yeah. You want to know a sad thing about this? On the History Channel thing that I had printed out when I was reading it, it says at the bottom, it says, did you know that more than 400 unclaimed bodies from the Jonestown tragedy are buried at the Evergreen Cemetery in Oakland, where a lot of his followers were from? So 400 people have not been claimed.
Yeah, and there's 200, I have here that 248 of the bodies, 248 of them are mostly children, and
that's just terrible,
which is most of the kids, because you said there was about like almost 300 or something like that. So
yeah, there was probably like a good third of the people there were children.
Yeah, and it just this is a case that is very disturbing, and
it is.
And I kind of, because in that one iconic helicopter shot where all the bodies are laid out, it kind of makes me like, did they go lay there, or
did,
like,
they just drop?
Did they just drop, or like what were they doing for those amount, like? And that's where your dad's theory kind of makes a little sense to me, because what if Jim Jones had got shot and they all started running outside?
That's what is kind of weird and questioning about it, because it says that as it was going, he was delivering his final sermon, and you can listen to this in what's called the death tape, which is I've heard it. It really just puts goosebumps on me, because it's you just hear like the evilness in his voice, and then you hear these people kind of, some people are screaming, some people are getting into the sermon. It's a very half and half type of thing, and he's telling them like, we need to do this, like, my people who I love, if you love me, then you will do this for me. And so he's delivering this final sermon as these people are drinking it, and then he somehow leaves. So it's like, oh, so you're not going to stick around and have them, like, it's like, okay, they're not going to watch you do it.
He could have very easily escaped that situation.
Yes.
Maybe that's what he was trying to do.
Yes, and that's why my dad's theory kind of does get a little bit more like, okay, because... I mean, he could have easily escaped into the jungle, got a whole new identity, and live out somewhere else. But yeah, either he was a coward and was like, I'm going to shoot myself, or someone prevented him from trying to
escape.
Yeah.
Yeah, and was his wife there?
I think she was.
That she drink the juice too?
I believe she did. I know his sons were in Georgetown.
Yeah, so his sons didn't die.
Yeah.
So she did die with him in Jonestown.
Yeah.
Which
Well, hold on.
is
He had four kids. I know one of them survived. I don't know if the others ended up going back and killing themselves or.
I know of two of them that I've seen I've seen two of them alive that are alive now.
Yeah, Jim. I know Jim Jones Jr. is.
Yes, and I believe also his son Stephen Gandhi Jones, which I believe is his biological son. So, I mean, it just this was a case that really was a weird kind of, it doesn't make sense. I guess for us it doesn't make sense
Oh,
because
he had nine children.
whoa.
He had nine. Let me see. Ooh, let me
Oh, I'm
see.
looking at here too. Yeah, he has nine. He has, yep.
Okay, so yeah, his surviving sons were Stefan, I mean Tim and Jim Jr. They were at Cause they were in Georgetown because they were playing basketball against the Guyanese national team. So that's why they were in Georgetown. And then, let
His
me.
one of his daughters did, at least one of his daughters did die.
Yeah, Lou. Lou did.
Agnes did as well.
Did Suzanne? Oh, no, they
Oh,
weren't.
he had a 3-year-old son that died that day
Oh my
too.
God.
An actual baby, 3 years old.
Jesus Christ. Yeah. Suzanne.
She survived, but she died in 2006, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I just wonder how they feel,
I
His
know.
ado his adopted son from South Korea, Lou Eric Jones, did die that day also.
Yeah, Lou did. I know, so his surviving one, Jim Jones Jr., who I know is still alive, I can't, I don't want to like say for real, like, because I'm not entirely sure, but I do know that he was very upset at because his wife, who was pregnant with their child, died. And it, I think he would, that's what, he was angry at that, but then he can also help because like Jim Jones did raise him. So
Yeah. That's tough. And I wonder how many of his children are agree with not with what happened, like the mass suicide, but agree with, what he was saying, and if they at the time they probably did, but if maybe that changed, or how they feel about it today. 'Cause that is their dad, and but
yeah. It was their dad. He raised them. He gave them a life and yeah.
And clearly, I mean, I clearly, I would assume that his family was also living pretty, lavish in terms of the other people. If his sons were allowed to go play basketball, in the other
Yeah.
town.
Yeah. Who knows how many
So,
more? They probably wouldn't be here either.
yeah, maybe it's like a blessing in disguise, that they were gone. So there was only 85 people who survived this thing because they were either away, or I don't know how else you could have survived that,
Yeah, if they were at the airstrip, they escaped into the jungle.
Oh yeah, those. But they, I mean,
Yeah.
they survived a whole different thing. They survived being shot at, and they survived the mass suicide.
Yeah, it.
Maybe the
See,
reporter
ooh.
should have just came with FBI and CIA.
Exactly.
Like, instead of going and doing a report, like, maybe just, hey, like, we know that there's shady stuff going on.
Yeah, it was. And this is where people, this is where the phrase drink the Kool-Aid means, where they tell you to not drink the Kool-Aid, because basically it means don't get yourself too deep into an idea or, like, movement, because it takes over your life. You become dedicated to it. I mean, that's what happened with these people. They got into the People's Temple. It became their life, and it ultimately was the end for them.
Yeah, and it's sad to me that people, I'm not a very religious, I'm very spiritual, but I'm not a very religious person.
Same.
But, I mean, you know, it's just the people who use religion to their advantage, or use, you know, people's sense of wanting to belong, or sense of, you know, I can just imagine, like, how many of these people were maybe, like, broken, or, you know, were just in need of, like, guidance, and they just chose to follow the wrong guy.
Yeah. And it brings me to this question, which I kind of hinted at on our Instagram, which, do you think that this was a mass suicide, or was it a mass murder? Because I think it goes both ways, because it's like they did, some of these people did do it willingly, but then you have the people who were forced to do it, who probably were like, I don't want to do this, and then they kind of forced it, so then it kind of is like,
it blurs the line a little bit about where that is. On one hand, I guess for people who did it willingly, mass suicide, but then for the children, for the people who were forced to do it, definitely mass murder.
Yeah.
And I could not even, I always imagine, I do this really weird thing where sometimes in movies or sometimes in cases like this, I want to try to put myself in that situation, like, and I tend to not just imagine, like, a really dumb example, but, like, when I was little, I used to watch Titanic, and I would, like, imagine if I was on Titanic, and, like, if my siblings were there, like,
yeah,
like, what lengths would I go to, like, and I, you know. And I can't even, this is one that I cannot imagine myself in, only because, one, I'm not super religious, so maybe if I were, like, back then at that time, I would have been, or I don't know, because that was, like, the norm, but I can't even see myself even, like, following someone to that extent. I think, like, from the moment that he would have been, like, okay, like, we're gonna move to Guyana, I would have been, like, okay, that's my signal, peace out, you know, like, see you later or never, you know?
Yeah, and I agree, because I'm also someone who is not really religious. Like, I have read parts of the Bible, and I've read different scripts from other religions in their books, because I feel like it's good to know about other things if you're questioning, or just to kind of get a sense of why people follow it. Mm-hmm. And it even says in the Bible, like, you shouldn't idolize. Like, when you idolize someone, that's when it can bring a downfall. And that's what happened to these people. They idolized him. They saw him as the prophet, as the second coming of Jesus. And that's why, after learning about cults, anytime I hear someone who would say something like that, I'm like, okay, I'm gonna stop you right there. Like, this is, you're crossing some waters right here.
I mean, look at Joel Osteen. He's, like, on the brink of a cult right there.
Yeah.
He's, like, if this is, like, the Jim Jones, like, cult, he's, like, right here. He's, like, about to cross the line.
Yeah. These cases are just terrifying, and they're scary, and I think that's why in all of true crime that cults are probably the most, like, I can't think of the word, but they're kind of like the most, they're the ones that you just can't believe will get to a certain extent.
Yeah, because there's some stories that I'm like, not that I could see it happening, but, you know, like, you can kind of not rationalize it or reason, but you see why it happened. You see why certain things fell into place. But something like cults, I'm always like, It all and you know what? It all starts out with people who it the that's like the cult recipe. It's like a person who wants to be in charge and lead people, and broken people, or people that need guidance, or people that
Vulnerable.
are vulnerable, and then you add them together, and then that's when you get a
Boom.
cult.
You've got a cult.
You've got a cult. So if you're questioning whether you're in a cult or not, just take a good look and think, do you have a leader who's manipulative, maybe, who's
Yeah.
maybe just extra in charge of and controls every little aspect? And are you a vulnerable person? Do other people in this congregation that you're in, are they vulnerable too? If you said yes to both of those, you're probably in a cult.
You're probably in a cult.
I mean, and if we're talking about ourselves, I am definitely in a cult then. Stephanie Meyer. Twilight fans.
My God.
Just to tie it all back, just bring it right around.
Stephanie, don't sue us.
Don't sue us, Stephanie. We don't think you're a cult leader, but you have started a cult.
Yes.
Unknowingly, you've started a cult. And I mean, and I wonder, sometimes it's like some of these cult members or these cult leaders, is there an intention to start a cult? Like, when does it go from just wanting to help and lead people? And when does that turn into a cult? Like, when is Joel Osteen gonna turn into a cult? Is my
I think it just has to do with power and how much power. When they get that power hungry, it just all goes from there. So, 'cause I think that's how it is for most of these cults. It's like, I will say there's one cult where I feel was an interesting case, and that's the last cult we're gonna get into this season.
Yes.
'Cause I don't know, I don't think that was about power compared to these others. So,
That one
but
was
we'll get into
weird.
that. That one's weird.
That one's weird. But yeah, so before we go ahead and talk about what we'll be talking about our next episode and all of that juicy stuff, we're going to determine whether we both think that this case is very eerie, extremely wicked, or quite spooky.
You
So,
wanna go first?
I'm in between very eerie and extremely wicked.
I'm leaning more toward extremely wicked,
I think me
mainly
too.
toward, yeah, I think in the beginning I would have, like, if it was how it was in the beginning and we didn't have this tragedy that happened and it was just like a cult that is very kind of like out there and you got this charismatic leader, I would say very eerie. But that we have the tragedy and we have how it concludes, I'm like, okay, this was extremely wicked.
Yeah, I'm leaning more on the extremely wicked side. I think the part that's very eerie for me is like the pictures. The you know, the pictures, the part about the children, that's all very, you know, that's eerie to me, 'cause that's just like another thing that I like, it's so hard to touch on. But everything else that he did, you know, the manipulating, the lying, the deceitfulness from him is extremely wicked. And it was so extremely wicked that he got 912 people
To do this.
to do this and to, you know, to die in this very, you know, what do you say, revolutionary suicide, which is not revolutionary at all.
No, it was very,
At
it
all.
was.
And you know, like, rest in peace to the people and who were a part of this, and I hope that their souls
And
are, you know, at peace, because this is something that's like, this is like a heavy thing to put on your, like, not to go into spirituality, but you know, souls are like a very big thing. I think this is like a really heavy, tragic thing to put on someone's soul. And so I just hope that whatever soul was dealing with these past events, that they are
Yeah, and my heart goes
dealing
out
with
to the
it.
survivors
Oh, for sure.
who probably are still traumatized to this day.
And they're probably still trying to cope with, you know, you have little things like, if I didn't do this and I had did this instead, I probably would be dead. Or, you know, what if I never had went? Like, or, you know, just the survivors, of what if they convinced one of their friends to go to this church and one of their friends ended up dead? That would have been a very something to, that's like something to struggle with. Well, so this was a very heavy pilot episode.
This was.
Our next one, I hate to say, but probably is not going to get any better.
No.
We are going to be talking. Our next episode is on February 1st. We will be talking about the Manson family. And all everything about them.
That's gonna be a very, very interesting case we talk about, because that has a lot.
It does have a lot.
Which, that one also, like, I'll have to bring in my dad's thoughts to that, because my dad has some thoughts about these cults.
Yeah. So, you guys might be having some little special guests from both of us. My father is also really big into crime, and probably where I got it, and Ree likewise. So we might have our fathers on for a little, for an episode or two. My dad thinks he's going to be famous, so.
That's so cute.
Yeah, he was, like, telling my uncle, like, I'm going to be famous, I'm going to be on Raven's podcast. And I was like, Dad, he's like, we haven't even put our first episode yet.
That's so funny.
Oh, my goodness. But, yes, tune in. But also, go check out our Instagram, and let me pull it up so that I can get the name right. It's Extremely Wicked, at Extremely Wicked Podcast on Instagram. I believe our TikTok is The Extremely Wicked Pod, on TikTok. Our names are our usernames right now are everywhere. Bear with us. We can't have the very eerie, extremely wicked, quite spooky podcast on as our tag name. So bear with us on names. But if you want one place to find all of our links to everything, we're going to go ahead and on our Instagram, there'll be a link tree. You can go on there. It'll have our Spotify. It'll have our YouTube, where we just upload the audio onto YouTube. It'll also have our TikTok, Twitter, anything that you can possibly find about us. And that's it. So we hope you guys enjoyed this podcast. We had a great time talking today. At least I did.
This was a great pilot.
And we are excited to see where this takes us. And we will keep you updated with posting schedules and seasons. So we'll see you guys later, and we hope you have a very spooky day.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye.